Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a conversation with Isabel Wilkerson from this year's Portland Book Festival, which took place online and on the radio just last month. In 2016, President Barack Obama awarded Isabel Wilkerson the National Humanities Medal for her first magisterial book, The Warmth of Other Suns. The book chronicles one of the great untold stories of American history, the decades-long migration of Black citizens who fled the South for northern and western cities in search of a better life. It went on to spend months on the New York Times bestseller list and has been hailed as a modern classic. Wilkerson began her career as a journalist and became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in journalism and the first African-American to win for individual reporting. Wilkerson joined us at the Portland Book Festival to talk about her new book, Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. It is an astonishing reframing of American history and our founding myths that is vital to understanding what is happening in America today, socially and politically. Wilkerson is in conversation with writer Viet Thanh Nguyen, author of numerous works of fiction and nonfiction, including the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer. Here's Nguyen.
It's such a pleasure to be back here in Portland, virtually at any rate, and it's a tremendous pleasure to be here in conversation with Isabel Wilkerson. I've been a big fan since The Warmth of Other Suns. I'm sure you've heard that a million times before, but I just want to start off by at least talking just for a second about that book and its relationship to Caste for me, because as a writer, I really admired The Warmth of Other Suns and its masterful storytelling, and the way that you have of shifting the language in order to get us to look anew at something that we think we already know. So in The Warmth of Other Suns, it was this idea of using the concepts of migration and of refugees to understand the movements of Black people out of the South. And as a migrant and a refugee myself, I found that to be, you know, just really affecting to get me to think again about the length of the journeys that Black people were undertaking within the country that sometimes exceeded the journeys that people were taking from outside the country to come in. And I think in Caste, you're doing something similar as well, obviously with the very title of the book, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But in reading the book, I was constantly struck by the way you would just shift the language in order to, I think, especially for Americans, force them to think again about a history that they have oftentimes chosen to forget or neglect or try to cope with in some way. I think about your use of language such as using pogroms to describe the massacres of Black people, describing slavery as an economy of torture, talking about plantations as labor camps where people were forced labor, bringing up histories of medical experimentation and the idea that what was being done to Black people constituted war crimes and crimes against humanity. And I think a certain number of Americans would find these words and these ideas hard to swallow as applied to what has happened in the United States. I'm not one of those people. I think that you have forcefully brought home some of these issues that never again should someone be able to have their wedding in a forced labor camp and think it's okay to do that. Now, the biggest shift that you ask us to undertake is this idea of thinking about inequality in our society through the idea of caste instead of something like race. So I just want to start off by asking you to tell us, why is that necessary? What does the concept of race do differently for us than, for example, race in terms of understanding our deep inequality?
Well, thank you for that question. And first of all, I wanted to say how much I appreciate and I'm grateful to be able to be here today. I wish I could be in Portland in person. And I'm just thrilled to be here in conversation with you. Such an honor. When it comes to the use of the term caste, it's a word that I began to discover in working on The Warmth of the Suns. I mean, that was a book that was about the out-migration, I would say, in fact, defection of 6 million African-Americans from the Jim Crow South to the rest of the country. And it was not just people moving, it was really people who were seeking political asylum within the borders of their own country. And so in doing that, it forced me as the writer to, an investigator, you might say, to understand what was it that they were fleeing? What would propel 6 million people to defect from that part of the country for everywhere else? And it turned out that the world that they were living in was essentially, we know of it as Jim Crow, but it actually was so much more than what we usually learn. It was so much more than water fountains and restrooms with, you know, color only signs. It was really a regime of repression in which everything that you could and could not do was based upon what you look like. And that it was a hierarchy, a rigid hierarchy, in which the boundaries and the policing and enforcement of those boundaries of the protocols, laws, and expectations within that world were more akin to a caste system. And it was a world in which it was against the law to merely play checkers together in Birmingham. You could go to jail if you were caught playing checkers with a person of a different race. It was a world in which there was actually a Black Bible and an altogether separate white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in court. That means that the very word of God was segregated in the Jim Crow South. And these were just a few of the many, many examples of the repression and the control and the specificity of that control, the customs and protocols that kept the groups not just apart, but with a rigid hierarchy in which it was very clear at every moment who was dominant and who was subjugated. And so trying to tell that story, I mean, I ended up interviewing over or speaking with over 1,200 people in order to narrow it down to the three protagonists that I chose. But in the process, I was talking to people who were survivors of that regime and then hearing their experiences. And then also looking at the work of anthropologists who went into the Jim Crow South in the depth of that system in the 1930s and 40s, and spent months of doing ethnography and participant observation and field work. And they emerged from their studies, their research, using the word caste. Caste seemed to be the more comprehensive language to describe what was in some ways the bedrock foundational region, foundational interconnections that ultimately would spread to the rest of the country, if not in law, then in practice. In the ways that we saw redlining and restrictive covenants and hypersegregation in the places that people migrated to. So this was the foundation. That foundation had had its origins in the founding of this country when it was a colony along the Chesapeake. And it was there in the early 17th century that the British colonists arrived here, decimated the numbers of indigenous people, drove them from the land, and then transported Africans to be enslaved, to build the country out of wilderness. And that set in motion a bipolar caste system where the laws and customs and protocols that ensued in the following decades created a world in which there was a dominant group of people who were the British colonists and the subjugated bottom group, which were people who are African. And in this case, you're asking about the use of the term race versus caste. What it meant was that caste as an idea, as a phenomenon, is thousands upon thousands of years old, predates the idea of race. And any hierarchy that's set up could choose any number of metrics in order to apportion, to divide, and to rank people. And in this country, this very, very fairly new concept known as race, which only goes back for 400 or 500 years, was the metric that was used in order to identify, characterize, and to apportion and to assign people to a fixed place in what was ultimately going to become the United States. And we live with the after effects of that to the current day.
Well, you bring up after effects, and you also used words like defection and political asylum. which again, Americans, I think, are not used to thinking, oh, we have to defect from the United States or we have to seek asylum within our own country. And yet that is exactly the argument you're making for the experiences of people who are at the bottom of this caste system and who are subjected to all kinds of horrifying crimes around labor, torture, and so on. What it also implies, though, is that we have a country that's actually at least two countries, a country that's experienced one way by those at the top of the caste system and another country that's experienced a completely different way by those at the bottom of the caste system, and that there are long-term consequences for this that extend into the present. And I think in the book, you make that very clear, because if I understand it right, you were finishing this book at the beginning of the pandemic. There are sections of the book that reference the pandemic and also the Trump administration, the political elections, the presidential elections of 2016 and the election that was about to happen in the spring. So let me ask this question from your perspective. Does Trump and the Trump administration represent the last line of defense of a caste system that is built around defending white supremacy?
Well, I'm not a political scientist, and my focus is on the interconnectedness and the power relationships that develop as a result of a hierarchy, not of the making of anyone alive today, but that we've inherited. I often describe our country as being like an old house, and you don't want to go into the basement when after rain, but you don't go into the basement at your own peril. These are longstanding assumptions, stereotypes, and power relationships that transcend any one election, any one campaign, any one politician. This hierarchy, this caste system, which I should give a definition of it, the definition that I came to, that, you know, I first used this language in The Warmth of the Suns, and when people would read it, it just rolled into understanding. I mean, readers just went along with the flow because the stories and the experiences of the people affirmed the relevance and accuracy of the comprehensive nature of the idea of caste. But I use the term caste because caste actually is language that, as you mentioned before, in some ways allows us to see past what we think we know. It is language that we're not accustomed to seeing, and clearly the language that we've been using up until now, the ways that we've been looking at ourselves up to now, have not been working. I mean, we have seen in our current era people literally being killed before our very eyes. George Floyd obviously comes to mind most particularly. And this is something that should not happen to any human being anywhere on the planet. In our era, we should be more advanced than this as a species. And yet we saw that occurring, not just somewhere in the planet, but in our own country. And so these are the kinds of things that we are seeing as manifestations of the sort of the afterlife of this originating hierarchy. But caste as an idea means actually caste is an artificial, arbitrary, graded ranking of human value in a society. And it determines one's standing, respect, benefit of the doubt, assumptions of competence and intelligence and beauty even. It determines access to resources or the deprivation of access to resources. So when I describe all this, I'm just saying that this is part of the foundation of what we have inherited as Americans. This is not something that any one campaign or any one administration or any one politician can in itself. It's not about that. It's about the enduring legacy that we've inherited and the ways that it manifests itself. And when you think about that old house, you know, you don't want to go into the basement after rain, but you don't go in the basement at your own peril, because whatever's happening in the basement, we have to address that whether we wish to or not. It will bubble forth and it will affect us whether we wish to or not. You know, ignorance is no protection against against one's inaction, the consequences of that inaction. And so what this is asking of us is to learn the history of our country so that we can understand this old house that we've inherited. We did not build these uneven pillars and joists, but we are the inheritors of it now, and it's up to us, and it's on us to be able to deal with this. Many of the things that we might be seeing are merely manifestations of the inheritance that has not been dealt with up until now. The language that I'm suggesting here allows us to see things without sometimes the freighted emotions that can be evoked with the language that we almost can't even hear anymore because we've heard it for so long. You know, it allows us to, in some ways has the potential to liberate us from the unhelpful emotions of guilt and blame and shame, and allows us to see the infrastructure. CAST is not about feelings. It's about this infrastructure, the architecture of our divisions, the history and the origins of how we got to where we are. And the language that we've been using up until now, the ways that we've been looking at this up until now, have not been working as they could. We even had, you know, a civil rights movement that made great strides in our country. We had, you know, the civil rights legislation of 1964, 65, and 68. We had changes in the immigration laws. We have opened up for women of all races and all backgrounds, and for so many people. But we are seeing that we have not addressed all of these issues. We have seen before our very eyes the ways that this inheritance of division has remained with us. I mean, this, you know, I don't speak about elections so much, but we have seen the great chasm in our society. You know, just in recent weeks, we have seen it. It's still playing out before our eyes in the news. And so this is an effort to try to get us to be able to see beyond what we thought we knew, to look at the infrastructure of our division so that we can begin to heal from them.
You started off the answer, I think, by talking about the foundation of the country, not just in a metaphorical sense with the house, but the very foundation of the country starting from colonization, you know, the arrival of settlers from Europe, the genocide of natives, the importation of African labor, turning them into slaves. These are facts, as far as I'm concerned, in American history, although there are some people who would choose to deny these facts, but they're also facts that are subject to deep conflicts of interpretation. But if we start with that premise that the country is founded on colonization and on genocide and on expropriation of lands and so on, it gets us to this present day reality that you're discussing so forcefully, that our inequalities are deeply rooted or deeply built into the country, and that it's going to take enormous effort to transform them. Even things like the civil rights movement, Black Power movement have not been obviously successful at dislodging so many of the prejudices and assumptions and practices of racism and inequality and the caste structure. And I know that in the book, you refrain from trying to give us prescriptions or predictions and so on about how to deal with this, but inevitably you must be asked, if the foundations of this house are so deeply flawed from the very beginning, can we actually repair the house? Or do we actually need to do something much, much more radically different?
Well, you know, I present myself as the building inspector of this old house. I present myself as holding an X-ray of our country so that we can see, you know, beneath what we thought we knew. And so if you take that, you know, analogy to its next conclusion, you realize that the radiologist presents it and, you know, gives you the diagnosis, and it's the surgeon that does the operation. So I also believe that people who are from the historically subjugated group in this country who have to bear the brunt of this caste system on a daily basis are not the group that that the country should be leaning on. The people who are born to the subjugated group already bear the burden, and have borne the burden for far too long. And it is up to others in this country to do the work, to examine and go into the unseen corners of our country. People who have not had to bear the burden have an even higher responsibility to do the work of understanding how we got to where we are. And I would say, I just want to say a couple of things about how about the history of this as to why it's so relevant, and in some ways why so much discussion about a caste system in general, whether we're whichever one you're speaking about, we often end up spending a lot of time talking about the circumstances of the people who are at the bottom. And I feel torn about this because on the one hand, we spend so much time talking about what's happening with people on the bottom that we're not training enough of a spotlight on the responsibilities and the things that people who are situated elsewhere can do to help overcome these, you know, these man-made, constructed divisions that we live with. But I want to say a little bit about one of the reasons why we, you know, whether you look at the Indian caste system, where there's so much attention put on the Dalit people, formerly known as untouchables, in the United States, so much attention put on, of course, indigenous people who've been essentially exiled from much of the mainstream, but then also on those who have been enslaved, so much attention about the people who've been enslaved. And so we often think of that as ancient history that has nothing to do with us today. But I wanted to put in perspective, I think part of the challenge in answering your original question is we can't fix what we don't know. You know, we can't fix what we cannot name. We cannot repair what we have not yet even fully understood. And you can't repair or fix or heal what you haven't diagnosed. And so that's why I spent so much time on the diagnosis and trying define and describe what it is. But I wanted to say a couple of things that are in the book that helped to set the scene for and helped to put in context the magnitude of this history and how recent the history actually is, because we're a young country and we often don't think in these terms. The idea of slavery or enslavement, which is the foundation of the hierarchy that I'm talking about here, slavery lasted for so long. It lasted for 12 generations. How many greats do you have to add to the word grandparent to begin to imagine how long slavery lasted in this country? 12 generations. Of course, this was followed by another nearly 100 years of a formal legal Jim Crow caste system in the South, which was where most African Americans were living, and then spread in other ways once African Americans spread out, and then were met with tremendous resistance, hypersegregation, and other ways of limiting people. And so enslavement went on for so long that it will not be until the year 2022 that the United States will have been a free and independent nation for as long as slavery lasted on this soil. Again, it will not be until the year 2022 that the United States will have been a free and independent nation for as long as slavery lasted on this soil. The foundational, fundamental hierarchy that set in motion the power divisions and the power structure that we live with to this day, and the inequities that we live with to this day. Another way of looking at it is that enslavement went on for so long that no adult alive today will be alive at the point at which African Americans will have been free. The subjugated group, historically subjugated group in this country, will not have been free. No adult will be alive at the point at which they will have been free for as long as they were enslaved. That time will not come until the year 2111. It will not be until 2111 that African Americans will have been free for as long as they were enslaved. And so these are ways to begin to put in context the nature and extent and the fundamental facts of how we became as divided as we are, and also a reminder of how very new this idea of freedom is. I mean, in other words, it wasn't until the 1960s that African Americans were actually permitted into the mainstream of American life. So this idea of being able to move into the mainstream is a very, very new proposition. When we think about women being able to move into the general mainstream in terms of being protected from job discrimination, that also was folded in a lot of people don't realize that that was folded in to the civil rights legislation to bring women into the potential for parity. And of course, the Immigration Act of 1965 that also opened the way for people who were beyond Europe to be able to come into this country in larger numbers. So this is all relatively new, this idea of opening up the country to people who are beyond what had been the traditional dominant group in this in society. So this is still a continuation of the American project.
Yeah. I'm not sure if pessimism or optimism are reductive ways of talking about what you're describing, because on the one hand, we can be very pessimistic that change has been so slow in this country. On the other hand, as you described it, you know, we're trying to undo centuries of baked in oppression and inequality and so on. And short of a violent revolution, we're looking at centuries more work that needs to be done in order to unravel or to rebuild or to renovate, whatever metaphor you want to use, this damaged house that we're living in. But you know, you drive your point home very thoroughly by working through various kinds of examples and comparisons. And one of the comparisons that you bring up is the Nazi Germany model. And again, a lot of Americans do not want to see themselves compared to Nazi Germany, but you present this historical case for how Nazi intellectuals, if that's what you want to call them, looked to the United States in the 1930s for models of how to deal with racial segregation, racial hierarchies, and so on. And you argue that the Nazi plan for targeting Jews, for identifying them as a racial population, and so on, drew great inspiration from the American model. But some of the Nazis themselves were shocked at the degree of excess in the American model. So can you tell us more about that?
Well, I have to preface it by saying that one of the reasons that I began looking into Germany at all was because of Charlottesville. You know, in Charlottesville, you know, there we saw before our very eyes the merging of these two symbols, the symbols of the Confederacy and the symbols of Nazi Germany. The protesters themselves made that connection. They are the ones that made the connection. They saw across time and across ocean a connection, a shared perspective of values. They're the ones that pull those things together. What happened in Charlottesville, made me think about, sparked this interest in me to better understand what is it that Germany had done in the decades after the war to reconcile with, to somehow atone for what had happened in the intervening decades, what had happened in the war. And so that's what set me on the journey of even looking at Germany to begin with. I might not have had there not been Charlottesville. And so as I started to look to see how they had managed their memory of the war, I came to discover things or become aware of things that I never, ever would have known. I mean, one of them is that it turned out that German eugenicists actually were in dialogue with and were consulting with American eugenicists in the years leading up to the Third Reich. I had no idea that they had done that, there had been that connection between the two. It turned out that American eugenicists had written books that were huge bestsellers in Germany in the years leading up to the war, and that in fact those books written by American eugenicists were used by the Nazis in their school curriculum. I had no idea, would never have imagined such a connection. Now, the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate. Obviously, they did not need anyone to teach them how to hate. But it turned out, as you mentioned, that the Nazis had actually sent researchers to the United States to study the Jim Crow laws, to study the anti-miscegenation laws in particular, the laws that forbade marriage across racial lines. They also were studying and very interested in how the United States had found ways to define who could be assigned to which race. And of course, each state had different definitions for who could be considered Black, who could be considered Chinese, who could be considered a Native, who could be considered white. I mean, all of them had different ways of doing it. And the most extreme cases, of course, had what's called the one drop rule, which meant that if a person had one drop of African blood, any hint of African ancestry, they would be considered Black. And these were the range of things that they were looking at as they were attempting to develop what would become the Nuremberg Laws. These were just shocking things to discover in the process of working on this. Working on something in which I was trying to get to what is really critical in understanding this book, which is societies are in any way equal. They're not there. This is not to say that they are the same in any way. There are many, 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 many differences between the societies that I'm looking at in this book, but there are significant points of intersection. And the goal of all of this is to remember that this book was written by an American for an American audience, about America at a point of existential crisis in our country. And so in doing that, the era that we're in calls upon us to look for ways that we can better understand ourselves, better understand our country, and look to see the ways that we might learn from what has happened in other societies where there are these points of intersection.
Right. And, you know, well, first of all, I want to say when you brought up the issue of American eugenicists, I teach at the University of Southern California. One of our earliest century presidents was a eugenicist. We have a building named after him, but I don't think my university is unique in that regard. You know, that eugenics is, from our perspective in the early 21st century, eugenics might be a very neutral sounding term, but as you said, there's a horrifying connection there between this kind of a study and its application in the way that populations were actually treated and targeted. And yet the enshrinement of eugenics is embedded in things like the names of university buildings and all of that, which means that there isn't actually an urgent case for thinking about memorialization and the names of buildings and statues and all of that kind of thing. And as you point out in your book, contemporary Germany has done a fairly good job in terms of confronting its past, in terms of refusing to memorialize or to create monuments for Nazis, and in terms of trying to confront what Germany actually did to Jewish people and so on. And in comparison to that, the United States seems woefully behind in terms of confronting its past. Even the battles that we're having over whether or not we should have Confederate statues in public places seems so retrograde to so many of us. We shouldn't be having these kinds of battles, and yet, as you illustrate in the book, these battles are actually very deeply entrenched. And in one part of the book, you do talk about the takedown of a Confederate monument and the how much difficulty was involved in that. So perhaps you can talk about that.
That's such a good point that you make, that was in the city of New Orleans, where the mayor, Mitch Landrieu, after the Charleston massacre, he was distraught by the idea that the shooter in the Charleston massacre had been inspired by the Confederacy. And he thought, why do we have these monuments in our city? To the Confederacy, which was and he as having been traitors to the country, they were on the wrong side of history, and he felt that they should not be this. He was the mayor, and he said, if we don't want them here, we shouldn't have to have them here. So they made plans in order to remove them, and it turned out that it had to be done in the greatest of secrecy. It turned out that there was such resistance to it that the contracting company had to make sure that they were in disguise, that their faces were not visible, that no one could see. Even they had to cover their entire body so that their race would not be visible. They had coverings on all of the sides of a truck so that no one could see the name of the company. They had the license plates covered, and they did it in the middle of the night with police protection. All of this was required to merely remove one of the statues in that city. And there was such a tremendous pushback leading up to it, you know, that they are still, you know, still recovering from that. And yet, when you look in Berlin, where I spent quite a bit of time working on this book, there's a lot of travel involved in this book. When you go to Berlin, it's a major world city. And there in the middle of a major world city is a massive installation. It's several football fields wide. And that installation is the monument, the memorial to those who perished in the Holocaust. And it is, you know, it's a series of concrete rectangles that you can walk among them. But what's really distinctive about it is that there's no signage. There are no exhibition walls that describe what it is or what it's there for. There's no signage necessary. People know the history. Young people, children learn it from as young as they're, as soon as they're able to begin to comprehend what happened in the war, and it continues on through their school years. The places that are connected to the Nazis have been converted into museums, places of learning, places where people from all over the world can come and learn about what happened there, so that it can never ever happen again. They're all on the same page about their history. Now, that does not mean that they all agree on the politics. It doesn't mean that it's, you know, that things are perfect, but it means that they have a basic understanding and they are on the same page about what happened in the country. We, however, are not on the same page about our country's history. We're not even on the same page about what we're not on the same page for. We have such a long way to go to be able to try to understand what's happening in our country. And I can say, you know, when The Warmth of the Suns first came out, I was, you know, reminded of how much we really don't learn about our country's history. Because when I would go out and talk about that book, and people would say to me after they read it, they'd say over and over again, they would say, I had no idea that this happened in our country. I had no idea, especially for the people who were the older people I'd run into, they'd say, I had no idea that this happened in my lifetime. I heard that over and over and over again. I had no idea. Having an idea has consequences. It has consequences. It has consequences as to what policies we support, where we choose to live, where we send our children to school, those people who are employers, who you will employ, who you will assign to whatever positions you do. I mean, it has consequences throughout our society. And so it's time that we get an idea. It really, truly is time that we get an idea.
At one point in the book, you raise the idea that what we need is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in the United States, which I fully endorse. But given the divisions that you've already described, I'm actually fairly pessimistic that we could actually achieve a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I mean, to have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you either need to have all parties sort of agree to do it, or you need to have that imposed by sort of an external force. But it does speak to the point that you raised earlier, that it's not up to the people at the bottom of the caste system to try to do certain things to change it, but that people with greater power or greater access to these means need to take action themselves. And Landrieu is one example of a person who did that. You also mentioned that you did a lot of travel for this book. And I do want to talk about the making of this book. As someone who has spent 17 and 20 years working on books, I greatly respect any writer like yourself, who has also spent 10 and 15 years working on her epic tomes as well. And of course, in the history of Black intellectuals and Black activists, the necessity of travel has always been there, where Black people have had to leave this country to go to Africa or to go to Europe to make connections, to learn about comparative systems and alternative possibilities. And you did this as well, traveling to Berlin, but also to India to construct this book, where you're looking at analogous things that were happening in Nazi Germany, but also with Dalits in India. Maybe you could talk more about what the experience of travel did for you as a writer and as a thinker in this book.
If that book were a human being, it would be in high school and dating. That's how long I worked on that book. So yes, I end up spending a lot of time on the books because it is completely, totally research-based. It's based on ethnography. It's based on interactions with people. It's based on, of course, the research of those that have gone before us. So yes, I ended up doing a tremendous amount of traveling back and forth. And I found that my interactions with Dalits were particularly enlightening because I didn't know how I would be received. And it turned out that they often know so much more about the experiences of people in the United States than we know about the experiences of those who were at the bottom of the caste system in India. And they gravitate toward African-Americans, they gravitated toward me because they recognized the parallel placement. Of course, the societies are very, very different in so many ways, but they recognize the positioning and they recognize perhaps even more than I would initially how much we actually have in common. Many of the phenomenon translate almost directly in the experiences so that you end up, and from my experience was almost one of being able to finish each other's sentences when it comes to how people respond based on their positioning in the caste system. And so I found that to be just incredibly enlightening and you know, oddly comforting. Sad though, because it's sad that anyone has to experience any of these things at all. I would also say that the experiences of you know, we were talking about Nazi Germany, but I hadn't had a chance to say a little bit more about how all three of them actually had so many points of intersection. And one of them has to do with purity versus pollution as a primary hallmark of I actually, in the book, I describe 8 pillars of caste that I identified. And so one of the things that all three of them had in common, well, actually all three of them have all of them in common, but one of them that is a hallmark is purity and pollution. And in that case, that's the idea that the dominant group to great lengths to maintain what it perceives to be its purity and to protect itself from the perceived fear of pollution from those deemed subjugated or beneath them. So in, you know, I, you know, had a chance to hear more about and learn more about how that played out in India, both historically and even manifestations now. One of the examples of that is the idea of water. This critical element of life itself on this planet was carefully guarded and protected by the dominant caste in each of these societies across time, across space, across oceans. That was one of the points of intersection so that in India, Dalit people could not drink from the same cup or chalice, of course. In Nazi Germany, the Nazis, the Aryans were be separate from Jewish people in the waters. Jewish people were not permitted to wade in the pools along with Aryans. And in our country, African-Americans were prohibited from waters that were reserved for the dominant caste, for white people. This applied to pools into the 1960s. There are cases where after the civil rights legislation, in many towns, they would concrete over the pool that had been for white people. When they were ordered to allow Black people into those pools, they would rather close the entire pool down rather than to allow Blacks and whites or to swim in the same waters. Rules had life and death consequences. In Chicago, for example, there was a case of a young teenager who swimming in Lake Michigan, which was segregated. The very waters of Lake Michigan were segregated. And he happened to be swimming on a beach that was the Black side of that invisible line. And he happened to have waded into what was viewed as the white water. And he was stoned to death for having done so. And this set off one of the worst race riots or massacres in our country's history, part of the Red Summer of 1919. But these are examples of how this was a matter of life and death, this policing of boundaries. And this is something that was consistent across these three societies that I looked at.
Well, you bring up policing boundaries, and that language, of course, means that we can recognize how the problem of purity and pollution has not gone away. I mean, we're still at a time period when Black people in certain places will have the police called on them because somebody thinks they don't belong in that place, whether it's, you know, a Yale dormitory or whether it's Central Park, or the obsession that some people have in this country with building walls along our borders is an attempt to keep the entire country pure from certain kinds of contamination in the eyes of the people who think we need these kinds of walls and borders. But I want to end our portion of the conversation by touching on one other aspect of your book. And I'm sorry that we have not been able to touch on 90% of what your book is doing. But maybe one last thing is the flexibility of the caste system in certain ways, and the degree to which people can be complicit in the caste system, possibly against the interests of their own caste. And so you bring up some examples of this. You talk about how even though there's this polarization and there's a racial hierarchy with white people at the top of the caste system, whiteness itself is flexible to a certain degree. So people who were not considered white a century ago have now become white, speaking about certain European ethnicities. And there's a possibility that populations like highly diverse populations like Asian Americans and Latinos have before them this lure that they somehow could become aligned with whiteness, which might account for some of the gravitation of these populations towards a Trump presidency. And you also talk about things like how even if you belong to a caste, let's say you're a Black police officer, it doesn't mean you're immune from the need to reinforce these caste divisions. You bring up the example of Freddie Gray and his death in Baltimore in the back of a police van being driven by Black police officers. So I just wanted to end with that and let you have the final word in these last few minutes, if you can elaborate upon this endurance and flexibility in the caste system in which many people are tempted to participate against their own interests.
That is, I think, one of the singular most illuminating aspects of caste that very few other ideas capture. And that is, this is not about, first of all, the racism of our forefathers' era. This is not about white people not liking or hating other people. This is about a system in which everyone is in some ways enlisted, whether we wish to or not, because this is the prevailing hierarchy. And in order to survive and flourish in a hierarchy that has roots as deep as ours is that everyone learns the protocols, everyone learns the cues, everyone learns the assumptions and the order of value of human beings in the society. And people, it's a bipolar caste structure to begin with, but then anyone entering this bipolar system then has to navigate and figure out how to manage, how will they flourish, how do they survive in this caste system that predated their arrival. And one of the things, as being human beings who have arrived here and want to succeed, people enter into a pre-existing hierarchy, and do that, you must recognize, learn, and acclimate to the expectations of those who are dominant. Throughout our country's history, there have been adjustments made, mutations, expansion, and retraction of who can be in the dominant caste legally. At the turn of the 20th century, a very fraught time. There was a time where people who are now recognized as, without question, we now recognize them as white, which again, this is all a social construction. And this is a reminder of what a social construction it is, that there are many people who, from Eastern and Southern Europe who were not allowed in or seen as part of the white race. This is, again, because it's social construction. Shockingly, this is something that has changed over time to fit the needs of the dominant caste as it has seen fit. There's an interesting case of a Japanese immigrant at the first of the early part of the 20th century who made the case, went all the way to the Supreme Court, arguing that his skin was actually whiter than those of people who were identified as white. And he went to the Supreme Court saying, why can I not be considered as this in order to be a citizen? Because that was what was required. In order to be a citizen, you had to be white. And so he was advocating and petitioning for citizenship, and that was the route he was taking. They had to come up with this convoluted reason why skin color was actually not the prime determinant for admission to the white race. And again, even the term Caucasian is a construction out of the imagination of an 18th century German physician who collected skulls. And he collected all these skulls, and his favorite skull, the one that he deemed the most beautiful, was one from the Caucasus. And he then, this was a time where, Europeans and were looking for ways to explain the natural, so-called natural world, and use scientific, pseudoscientific ways of describing it. So the term Caucasian began to be applied based upon his delineation of humanity based on these skulls. And he assigned himself to the superior group, even though, of course, he was from Germany and not the Caucasus. So this is a reminder of the kind of arbitrary nature of these divisions that have then been the cause of, you know, enslavement and, you know, decimation of native people and heartbreak of immigrants, you know, walls that are being built. This is a reminder that this is all an artificial construction. And if this can be constructed, then it means that it can also be dismantled to the degree that people recognize how much we all have in common and how dependent we are on one another. And this is this, you know, I want to say that I actually in this book, I'm not, this is not an argument. I'm a narrative writer. I'm not arguing. This book is a prayer for our country, and it's a prayer for our country and for the planet, really, because our times call for looking past these artificial constructions and to seeing if we can find a way to transcend them.
That was a conversation between Isabel Wilkerson and Viet Thanh Nguyen from this year's Portland Book Festival. The Portland Book Festival took place entirely online and on the radio. And while the festival has concluded, we've recorded and posted all of the events in full and put them in our video library so you can catch the conversations you missed, rewatch your favorites, and share them with your friends and community. You can find them all by visiting literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Krista Liguori for radio and podcast, with production support from Serena Fong. Production oversight by Amanda Bullock, with support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Jyoti Roy and Alana Phelan, and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.